at zoom.us.
Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. We can't pay for the things you want to buy. Wear your old faded jeans, they are patched but they are clean. Walk proud, my son, hold your head up high.
Well, it's music from Don Grooms to start the Sustainable Living Program with John Butts this morning. Hi, John. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm good. I'm good.
You feeling September in the air?
Not yet. I was out yesterday. It did not feel like September.
Yeah. Well, we're getting through it, you know. Hey, I can actually get out to the dairy with a golf cart now, you know. I was kind of having to walk out there. It was so muddy, so it is drying out a little bit in Plant City, but still haven't kind of got my garden beds pulled up. It's still pretty wet on the end of the field. I kind of want to start the program. We had some sad news last week. Eve Praying Clues passed away, not this Saturday, but last Saturday, and a really kind of a shocker to the WMNF audience. Certainly was a part of the family, and she's really going to be missed. And of course, you know, my heart goes out to her husband and all her friends and family, and of course all of us, you know, we very, very somber, very much, like I say, she's going to be missed. And I don't know, Rob, you got any plans, or has there been any plans about her memorial kind of?
No, her family and friends said that they're going to plan a memorial that's going to take place probably at the end of the month, but we haven't heard yet. And as soon as we hear, we'll you know, post that on our website. Cool. So we haven't heard anything yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. And I always like to start by thanking our listener supporters here at WMNF. You know who you are, and we really appreciate your support to keep this great institution here in Tampa Bay alive and well. Rob, so what's up at 11?
Well, we're going to hear Florida this week, and we'll talk about some state election issues and also some local election issues. And we'll also hear part of President Obama's speech. Former President Obama made a rip-roaring speech on Friday, so we're going to hear part of that in the next hour.
Okay.
And we're going to hear lots of comments about Tanya Vidovic, who was banned from Felipe Park for objecting to the spraying of Roundup. So a lot of listeners wanted to comment about last Thursday and Friday's shows, both of which were on that topic.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tanya's here, and we're going to get a comment from her. This is the WMNF Sustainable Living Show. I'm Farmer John, and Rob and Frank Knox are here to kind of help out with the program. And Tanya is back. Tanya Vidovic is back this week.
She's not banned from WMNF, luckily.
No, no. And we were kind of wondering if she's been de-trespassed. Maybe some people were sleeping last week, but could you summarize what happened last week and so, where you are now?
Sure. I use Felipe Park as my main transportation to get my kids to and from school. And so we go through there about six times a day. So we noticed a sign that said invasive plant removal going on. Automatically, I thought, you know, they're going to be pulling invasives. Well, throughout the week, we saw this truck with probably a 1,000-gallon container holder of spray. And they were spraying. They were just broadcasting it everywhere. And we started noticing all the plants are dying. They're spraying the trees. They're spraying the natives also. So one day I stopped. I said, what are you guys spraying? And they gave me, you know, the technical name. And so I went home and I looked it up and I was like, oh, it's aquatic Roundup. Like, that's not cool. So I went back and I started talking to them. And, the conversation didn't last very long, but I was like, you know, what are these plants? You know what you're spraying? And they could identify one native, but they couldn't identify any of the other ones. And I was like, well, I've noticed, you know, there was a lot of the plants, the solidago, the red salvia, you guys are spraying trees, like the center of palm trees, like native ones, the sables. So they didn't like that. And then again, it was only a 30-second conversation. So I informed them that I was going to kind of just hang around just in case they were spraying the natives. that I was going to inform them that those are natives. Well, they called the police on me. One of the park managers came down, the police were there, and I was issued a trespass. So I was now told that I was not allowed back in the park. Ever, they said. And if I did go back in the park, I was going to be arrested. And like I said, that was my main form of getting my kids to school. So,
Now, were you threatening the people that were spraying? Or were you loudly objecting? Were you blocking their progress?
No, I was talking just like this. I wasn't blocking anything. So it shocked me. And I came on, gave an interview, and enough people were shocked that they also emailed the parks department, and they did take back my trespass, and that starts today. But they said that I'm not longer allowed to talk to any to any of the third party workers. So it doesn't look like they're going to be stopping the use of Roundup, aka poison, in our parks, which is disappointing. So I'm hoping that that enough people will come forward and say that they don't want it, in light, like you were mentioning, with the fact that it is poison, and it's a short-term solution for something, and we're poisoning our environment and where we're supposed to play for a short-term solution. What got me was the police report, because there's a police report on it where they said I was using vulgarities and I was threatening, and which I wasn't. So it upset me that there was.
You on your video camera, on your cell phone camera rather, videotaped your interaction with these park people and with the Roundup people.
Yeah, and
there's no profanity on that video.
No, I very, very rarely, I could say I swear probably once a month. Like, I don't swear pretty much ever. So it's crazy to me, because the police officers, never mind you, they were respectful to me enough, but like they said, they were doing their job. But their job would probably involve, in my opinion, interviewing me as well, getting my take on it, and not just putting in a police report, which is a part of my record, that I was aggressive using vulgarities, because I wasn't. So, I mean, there's somebody lied, unfortunately, and it's on my record now.
That's pretty outrageous. So anyway, I suspect that this issue of Roundup is going to come back in Pinellas County and all the other counties where it's being sprayed, as people get hip to what the World Health Organization says about Roundup.
I hope so. I hope that people come forward and go to their city commission meetings, their county commission meetings. I used to live in the Hillsborough River, and in the summertime, the boats would come by and they would spray the entire river with Roundup, with aquatic Roundup. And back then, I mean, I knew it was like bad, but not as bad as it was, but they're literally dumping poison, carcinogenic poison, in our water.
And you live right near where the source of all of Tampa's drinking water is stored, in the dam.
Well, I used to. Yeah. I moved since then, but that's right, so we would go to them and we asked them, and they said it was aquatic Roundup that they were spraying, and the reason that one of the people gave me was that because North Tampa, they have, and like Temple Terrace, there's so much fertilizer that comes down that the water lettuce and the water hyacinthus or whatever blooms so, thank you, that it blooms so much, and that so then there's all, then after they spray it, it's just dead plants everywhere. And I remember looking it up and seeing that other places that also have these issues have a dam. They use the dam for their benefit, and they almost like use a big slide and collect this the dead plants, and then they compost it, which would be a way better solution than poisoning our drinking water.
Mm. To be continued. And all the listener comments at the top of the next show are about you and about that situation.
So. Well, I'll be around for the next couple of minutes after the show if anybody has any questions.
No, we were warned, I think. It's funny, Silent Spring came out in the 60s, Rachel Carson's book.
Early 60s.
And, we've been warned about this, and we've been warned about a lot of things. Recently I picked up a book, it's called Our Stolen Future. And it wasn't so much like, the Rachel Carson's book was about how these chemicals were killing us. Well, this one, it was about, stuff that we never thought about, that how it affects our endocrine system, our hormonal system, and how these are killing our offspring, and how these chemicals are ending up in polar bears that were made in Nebraska, and it's just like, it's just unbelievable what kind of a toxic world we live in. And Roundup, it's like you say, it's really, I grew up, in Pinellas County, mowing grass, spraying Roundup. But spraying it on wheat, alfalfa, putting it on corn, GMO corn. It's just totally crazy.
Well, and putting it in our water. Like, that's the thing. Like, they're literally spraying it in the area where we have... Exactly. I mean, it's disappointing. And it's disappointing that... But the problem is, too, is that unless we're going to ban all the chemicals, because we could ban Roundup, but like I was saying, or what was told to me, was that even when... The people that don't use Roundup, there's other chemicals, like I guess the person said Mad Dog or whatever, that they're going to use that's in the same family. So until we ban ingredients and all these horrible ingredients that we're putting in there, I mean, it's hard to fight against corporations that, you know, well, that that's their job, is to get paid to
you know. All we can do is try.
Exactly.
And we really kind of got to move on and stay tuned at 11. We'll be talking more about this. On today's show, we were going to talk about minimalism. And you heard Don Groom's song there at the beginning of the show with a couple of guests. But first, we have a physics professor, and he's with MIT. And he's been involved with climate science solutions and policies for the last 20 years. Joe's worked with governmental agency, nonprofits, and private businesses to develop strategies to stop climate change. And is the founding editor of climateprogress.org, and has spent the last 10 years talking to audiences about this existential issue facing our planet. This year, he's updated his book, Climate Change, What Everybody Needs to Know. Welcome to WMNF, Joseph Rahm. What an honor to have you here. You're there, Joe.
Oh, yes. Thanks so much for having me.
Cool. You know, I was listening to Democracy Now!, and there's a lot of ruckus out there in California today about climate change. And to start, I really have to recommend your book to everyone. You know, truly feel it's one of the most important books we may ever read. So maybe you can start there, Professor Rahm. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Sure. Well, I haven't been a professor for a while now. I'm mostly a communicator and writer and speaker, and I worked as Assistant Secretary for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy back in the Clinton administration. So the Oxford University Press has a series of books called What Everyone Needs to Know. They're kind of primers. And they asked me to do the one on climate change, the science and the solutions. And the nice thing about the format is that it's all Q&A. So there's like 100 questions with answers, so you can just pick it up almost anywhere. Read, you know, if you're concerned about, let's say, sea level rise or extreme weather, or you want to know about solar energy or electric cars, you can just read that question and answer in a few minutes. And it's gotten, you know, a good response, and I think it's probably, you know, if someone wants an introduction to the entire subject area, which, you know, I certainly recommend, because I've, you know, as I say in the book, I think climate change and our response to climate change over the next 25 years will be as important to your listeners and their families as the internet and information technology has been in the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm. You know, a couple of things that I've never kind of seen in a book like this is the actual effects of CO2 on humans and the effects of the heat, our productivity as far as people working outside in the heat. Could you maybe talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. In recent years in particular, for a long time, scientists had really expected the leaders of the world would listen to them and take action to avoid this, you know, danger posed by, you know, heating up the planet and all the impacts that will cause, the sea level rise and the droughts and the extreme weather. But now that it's clear that, you know, we're going to see some amount of impacts, scientists have started to do more research into what those impacts are going to mean for people. And I think, one area that has not gotten a lot of attention is the fact that the carbon dioxide levels, particularly indoors, affect human cognition. And you know, if you're in one of those office buildings, and maybe you're like in an all-day meeting in a room which is crammed full of people, you probably notice it feels stuffy and you start, you know, feeling lethargic. And you may think, oh, well, it's because the meeting's so boring. Well, that may be too. but the part of it is, you know, the CO2 levels build up indoors, particularly in crowded places like school classrooms and meeting areas and conferences and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, the latest research is that as CO2 levels rise towards, you know, 1,000 parts per million indoors, it starts to affect people's performance at work. And a separate impact on human productivity is the fact that, you know, we're now seeing many more extended heat waves. I'm sure you've noticed that down in Florida. You know, heat waves that are more intense, but also that just seem to last longer. And, you know, as you expose people to particularly a combination of heat and humidity, so you get the heat index, it's very hard for people to work outdoors. And, you know, a lot of activity, a lot of work people still do, whether it's in the agricultural sector or construction or road work, people spend a lot of time outdoors. And, you know, as the heat index rises, that just becomes harder and harder for people to do for an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm. I've kind of noticed that, especially as I get older. And another thing about the book that really kind of surprised me was the rate that this is increasing, and the actual numbers that were given to us like 10 years ago are very low. And it's kind of funny because I do kind of look at the National Geographic, and they've had a lot about the Arctic and what's happening there. And you know, I'm looking at that and I'm saying, you know, this just doesn't sound good.
Well, I think, you know, For many years, you know, I would say for, you know, 25 years, scientists have said, well, if you keep putting in these heat-trapping gases, burning fossil fuels, carbon dioxide is the big heat-trapping gas, you're going to heat up the planet. And by the way, it's going to heat up about twice as fast in the Arctic. And that's been happening. And when you heat up, you know, a place that's got a lot of ice, obviously the ice is going to melt. And, you know, the Arctic has the Greenland ice sheet, which has, you know, it's basically a country the size of roughly Mexico with about a mile thick of ice on it. So it is a very big ice sheet, and as it melts, and other ice sheets too, particularly Antarctica in the southern hemisphere, you see the sea level rise, and that has sped up. And I think the speed up in sea level rise in the last 10, 15 years has, you know, has definitely surprised people, as has the speed up in the kind of disintegration of these ice sheets. And there's a great fear that we are near some tipping points where it's you know, I tell people, if you take an ice cube and put it out on the table in the, you know, middle of a warm room, right, the ice cube's going to melt. If you wanted to refreeze that ice cube, right, you would have to make the room, you know, it's really hard to do, because melting is a difficult process to reverse. So the point is, once you start melting these giant ice sheets, at some point, you're not going to be able to stop unless you could lower the temperature, which you can't do, you know, over a short period of time. So I think the problem is that unless we act, you know, pretty aggressively in the next, you know, in the coming years to you know, embrace clean energy, reduce carbon pollution, then, you know, places like South Florida are going to see, sea level rise by the end of the century, know, 4, 5, and 6 feet, and by mid-century, you know, potentially another foot. And you know, you live down there. I've been many times, so you know how flat, you know, much of southern Florida is. And so I think people often just, you know, don't focus enough on the long-term trends, and I think it's important to listen to scientists here and understand that we are definitely running out of time.
We're talking with Joseph Rahm, who is the author of the book Climate Change, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's the founding editor of Climate Progress, which is a blog that covers climate change, and he has a PhD in physics from MIT. You're listening to the Sustainable Living Program on WMNF in Tampa. So, Joe, over the next 50 years and 100 years, how high are seas projected to rise?
Well, you know, at the end of the book, the Climate Change, Whatever Needs to Know, I discuss what I, you know, the impacts on everyone, and I think that will be in the coming decades. So, sea level rise, you know, we could see a sea level rise of a foot by mid-century, and you know, in the latest science suggests that we could see sea level rise, you know, of 4, 5, or 6 feet by the end of the century, and then it keeps rising. I mean, it, you know, we're talking about rates of sea level rise in the second half of this century that would be like 6 inches a decade, and eventually by the end of the century, a foot a decade. So these are, you know, it's not just a high sea level rise, but the rate keeps going, and that makes it quite hard to adapt to. And I, you know, we're already seeing in South Florida, I think I mentioned it in the book, and I've been writing about this a lot on the website, Climate Progress, that we're already seeing that places that are more susceptible to flooding are seeing much slower growth in property values than the areas that aren't as susceptible. And, you know, I think sometime in the next 10 or 15 years, there's going to be a real, you know, reckoning on coastal property values because, frankly, a lot of people are living in places that are not going to be there or are going to be subject to, you know, regular storm surges and flooding that will be quite serious, and it will get harder and harder, for instance, to get a 30-year mortgage. And at some point, you know, the most exposed coastal property is going to see a price shock. And, you know, one of the points of the book is that people need to be informed on climate change so they can make good decisions for themselves and their family.
Well, the odd thing about it is that if you go to Miami right now, they had a shortage of workers because the construction is booming all over Miami, which is only about 3 or 4 feet above sea level in most places. So right now, if you go to Miami, there's a construction boom. People are flooding into that area. Yet you say over the next decade or so, they're going to see prices maybe top out or maybe reverse. You know, that's the odd thing is that a lot of people are in denial about climate change. And the chief denier, I think, is well, there's two of them. Our governor and our president are in denial about it.
Well, look, I think there's no question that you know, Governor Scott has made, you know, he is banned discussion and analysis of the impact of climate change on the state, which is kind of crazy. And I think that, yes, in combination with President Trump at the national level, it has made it very difficult for the state of Florida to plan for what scientists, you know, are increasingly certain about. And in Miami, it's a very interesting situation. I've talked to many of the, you know, coastal experts at the University of Miami and elsewhere, and they don't have any doubt that you know, the Miami, Southeast Florida is on our current path, if we just keep sticking our head in the ground, that it's ultimately going to depopulate. It's as you say, it's exceedingly flat. And the other piece of it is that we're seeing more extreme storms. So last year, I know, Irma came up the coast and, was quite, not very far removed from a worst-case scenario for Tampa. And, as you raise sea levels and then throw in these extreme storm surges, eventually what happened in Houston with Hurricane Harvey, which is like, they called it a once in 10,000 year storm. But again, that's the way it used to be with climate change. The likelihood of such a storm is considerably greater. One of those is going to hit like Miami or a major city in Florida, and there's going to be a reckoning for the state in terms of who is going to insure this property and what the value of the property is going to be. So I think that the point of being informed is so that you can be ahead of the curve. I quote the senior vice president for Freddie Mac, who said 2 years ago, that when people eventually come to this realization of what's coming, there is going to be an increasing exodus or sale of the most at-risk coastal property, and the people who, the smart money will get out first, and if you, are a climate denier, you may be ending up holding property that is worthless. So, I think everyone should draw a decision for themselves. Certainly, Miami is especially unusual. A lot of the high-end property value in Miami is driven by foreigners, and they're just trying to get money out of their country. And so they're not, they're just saying, buy me, some expensive piece of property in a city like, international city like Miami, and they're not heavily focused on, climate change and things like that. But as I say, over the next 10 or 15 years, that is certainly all going to change.
Okay, well, we've been talking to Joseph Rahm about his new book. Well, it's not a new book. It's kind of you updated it this year, so it's very current information, climate change, what everybody needs to know. Joseph, we got to kind of move on. Is there anything else you want to say before we leave you?
Well, I think people are going to see, we have this new hurricane, Florence, approaching the Carolinas, and current indications are it is going to slow down and dump a lot of rain the way that Harvey did on Houston. And I think, it's just something to keep an eye on, that these types of storms, which used to be a lot rarer, are just becoming more commonplace.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining the show. And people can just find your book anywhere. It's pretty easy to find.
You can go to Amazon. Yeah, you can go to Amazon and look up Climate Change or Oxford University Press or my last name, Romm. That will take you to the book.
All right. Thank you very much, Joseph. And we're going to take a little short break, and we'll be right back.
Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa.
I was born in the mountains above Cherokee, North Carolina. My mother raised five kids on an income of $12.50 a month. When my oldest brother's clothes got down to me, there wasn't much left, but she'd wash them, patch them, and she'd say, "They're not much, son, but we didn't steal them, and nobody gave them to us. So you wear them, and you walk proud." So I wrote this song for that woman, my mother, the finest woman I know.
Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. We can't pay for things you want to buy.
Wear your old faded jeans. They are patched, but they are clean. Walk proud, my son, hold your head up high. We lived away back in the hills with the bears and the whippoorwills. Closest store was 35 miles away. Though I'm now a full-grown man, when I close my eyes I can hear the words my mother used to say. Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. We can't pay for the things you want to buy. Wear your old faded jeans, they are patched but they are clean. Walk proud, my son, and hold your head up high. Got a son of my own, he's even got his own telephone. Seems like I buy him something every day. He's got everything money.
You're listening to the Sustainable Living Program on WMNF in Tampa. John Butts is here.
Okay, and for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about minimalism. And our first guest is a writer, an artist, and a permaculture educator that lives in Daytona Beach. Jenny is micro-famous for living with a low carbon footprint. Welcome back, Jenny Nazak. Are you there, Jenny?
Hi, John. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm fine, thanks. How are you? What a lovely song to segue into.
I don't know why. It kind of grew on me.
Perfect one.
Well, Jenny, your book, do we have another guest there, Rob? Or,
yeah, Ani is on the phone,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you want to go ahead and introduce Ani, Tanya?
Sure, sure. I would love to introduce a local landscape designer, Annie Ellis, and she does local landscape design, including feng shui elements in her design, where you choose plants with a purpose in your design, including minimalism in your garden, how to lower your clutter, and including making landscapes pretty and functional at the same time.
Great, great. You there, Annie?
I am.
Great. Hey, how's your mom doing?
Oh, that's so sweet of you to ask. She's good, and my dad, too. I'm here in Mobile just trying to take a little care of them, and they love every minute of it as well as I do.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest, both of you, Jenny and Annie. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome. Yeah.
So, Jenny, tell us about Deep Green.
Okay, well, and it's so perfect because Tanya's segment and then Joseph Rahm's segment were perfect introductions, actually. Those two, they raised issues that were among my core motivations for writing this book. First of all, Tanya's experience with this Roundup, this is a very ongoing thing of humans being what I consider an invasive species. You know, I think it's very arrogant of us to even call some plants invasive species when often they're just the ecosystem's effort to repair itself. But so we're overly extending ourselves into the environment, so our footprint's too large. And then the issue, Joseph Rahm, of climate change, well, and also just plain pollution. We're trashing the environment. So I've been motivated for a long time to write a book to help humans who care reduce their footprint. And so I drew on a bunch of movements that I stumbled on, including the permaculture design movement and another footprint reduction movement called the Riot for Austerity, to write this book.
Cool. Now, you know, that kind of sounds funny. You know, I've seen that, you know, in the past, and I kind of looked at it and said, who would ever riot for austerity?
Well, and that's actually what George Monbiot said in his book. Like, we riot for all these things, but people don't riot for austerity. And that's how this grassroots movement that latched onto this book. It's another book about climate change and how to address it. And a bunch of grassroots citizens online latched onto this thing and started a movement, a footprint reduction movement. What else? Oh, okay. So my working title for this book was Grassroots Green Mobilization. And for quite some time now, about World War II, the austerity measures of World War II, as a model for I mean, back then it was government imposed, but as a model, that what about if grassroots people voluntarily did their own austerity movement for the good of the planet? And that's how I latched onto all that and wrote the book.
Mm-hmm. And you actually, you have some kind of a, I guess it's metric of how to do that, and maybe yes. talk about those. I think there's seven different things. Maybe briefly mention them.
Yeah. So this couple of climate activists who are bloggers, and not coincidentally both mothers, launched this movement, and they devised a set of metrics for how would we reduce our footprint by to 10% of the U.S. average. Not like a lot of people here might already have a rather small footprint in relation to the U.S. average, but the figure deemed essential in George Monbiot's book about climate change is we got to reduce our footprint by 90% of the U.S. average. So these gals developed metrics. There's electricity, the different categories are electricity, water consumption, generation of household waste. Consumer purchases. Let's see, what other ones? There's, I believe, gas, home heating oil, that's a category, or cooking is a category. I don't have it right in front of me, but there's these seven categories. Of course, gasoline, transportation. And so there's actually seven opportunities for people to reduce their footprint. Food footprint, that sometimes a person who doesn't find it easily to reduce their gasoline footprint could very easily reduce their food footprint. So there's many opportunities for people to reduce their footprint.
And, you know, it's kind of cool about your book, the frequently asked questions, which are great for, you know, a programmer that's interviewing somebody. But Tanya, you want to bring Annie into this?
Yeah, I would love to. So it's funny, when listening to both of you, and I was looking at Annie's page and talking to her, and I was looking through your website, and just with you mentioning, like, with things you can do in your lifestyle, in your yard, in order to make your life more minimal. And then also talking to Annie a little bit about with design and encompassing all of that. I mean, when Jenny says about water consumption, Annie, do you have any recommendations as far as reducing your water consumption in garden design?
Well, yes. One of the biggest factors is putting the right plant in the right place and putting the gathering of plants correctly. So they're all getting the same type of water requirements. And, of course, then there's the drip system. And there's also, little tiny micro sprays and such like that. But really, and mulch, of course. But really, I think the main part is knowing the right plant and putting it in the right place. I really do.
And then I love the way on Jenny's blog how she recycles. A lot of her, it seems like you do a lot of recycling projects too. I really enjoyed looking through, and there's some great ideas. Annie, do you ever use any sort of recycling in your garden designs for your clients?
Well, yes. You can. My focus, of course, I've been reducing use my whole life. I mean, that's my goal personally: reduce, reuse, and recycle. Of course, is the last ditch effort. So I try to go about every design. It is a personal thing for each person that I work with. So it is to, increase their interaction, really, with the outdoors. Because a lot of people in the city, which is where I generally work, are they just get in their car, go to work, come back, and go in the house. And when I make a garden for them, they tend to interact with it, and they didn't really know what they were missing until they were a part of it. So that actually cues them up for thinking about the environment. It all sort of works in a big green circle, if we put it out there for people that don't even think that way.
Sure.
It's an interesting thing. But in recycling, using different odds and ends, with the idea of beauty, I like to see what people have and bring things in, not bring things in, but reposition things that they currently have into a more beautiful, visually appealing way.
Sure.
Because I can get to their heart through their eyes.
easily.
No, it's great. I mean, you're making recommendations, and you have the education and design in order to do mm-hmm. that. And again, you're listening to Sustainable Living, and we're talking with Annie Ellis, a local landscape designer, and Jenny Nazik, who just wrote a book called Deep Green. So thank you, everybody who's listening. And I also want to say, call in, join the conversation. If you have any questions, we would love to hear from you.
We have two people on the line who are calling in. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Should we go to the caller? Jungle J is on the phone. All right, we're going to go to Jungle J.
Hi, Jungle.
Jungle J, hey.
Hey, how are you?
Well, thanks for holding on for so long, Jungle J.
Well, I'm happy to do it because, I have a couple of comments. I want to harken back real quick to Joe and his book and talking about sea level rise. And he was talking about the slow rise of sea level. But I want to throw in the prehistoric precedent for, you know, with the melting of the top of the glacier up there on Greenland and all the smog and everything that's fallen out, that's accelerating, and the liquid is going through the cracks of the bedrock. And there is a prehistoric precedent for events where an entire ice sheet can slide off its mooring, and humanity has been punctuated in the past by events like that. Not to frighten the life out of everybody, but it just reinforces the need to get the word out. And so Jenny's book, and I loved her previous title for it, The Grassroots Green Mobilization. That's basically what we're doing down at my new project, and I'll talk a little bit about that if we have time. But I did want to also mention that I set up an event for consciousness raising about parks and the herbicide that we're spraying all over Pinellas County. And so on the 6th, 1 month from this event where Tanya was told to leave her park, we're going to have a march to the mound against Monsanto, and I think we can use that as a rallying point to talk to our commissioners about ending this madness elsewhere in Pinellas County.
Cool, Jay. And, you know, go ahead and talk about your little project there in St. Pete.
Well, I appreciate that so much, and, I didn't want to come in with a big plug for it, but, we're starting something called the Urban Regeneration Station. It's in northwest St. Pete, actually in unincorporated Pinellas, which bodes well for us in, municipal interaction and so forth that we hope to engage the county with. Once we have built a grassroots proof of concept that we can then go, hey, look what we've done as a community. Do you think you can support it? And so the Urban Regeneration Station is on Facebook. The group is the Urban Regeneration Station. If you go to that page, you'll see pinned at the top is the March to the Mound against Monsanto is on there. But also, you get a flavor for all the things that we are, hopeful to do there. And as a matter of fact, tonight, I am actually financing the tuition for young people to go take the cooperative entrepreneurship program down at Pinellas Technical College with Judith Turner so that we can build the legal person, the nonprofit entity that will be the guiding force behind this. I keep saying, it's a railroad theme, the station, the love train and all that, but I don't want to be the engineer. I want other engineers. I need stokers, I need stewards, and the stewards will be the people, and I just want to be the conductor.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, it just sounds like it's going to be a really great location where the community is going to be able to be involved, and obviously you're a pillar in the community who's got your hands in everything, so thank you for starting this this project that you're taking on and putting so much effort into.
Well, it's a labor of love, and it's coming right out of my involvement at Beacon Food Forest Garden, and of course my wonderful relationships with people like you, Tanya, and you, Jetty, and all of the
Thank
folks
you.
In the permaculture convergence community.
Right.
It's just a wonderful place to be, and I believe wholeheartedly that the attraction will bring people along. And as far as the minimalism goes, and how this attaches to this theme, we're wanting to do this with minimal money. And that's the main emphasis. You know, we want to minimize the money and maximize the hub and really build this as reciprocity and local initiative that will be scalable, replicable, portable, and all of those things, but do it in the local communities where we build each other up first and then use that as a model for others to emulate.
Well, that's Jungle J Hardeman in Pinellas County. Jenny Nazak, let me go back to you, author of Deep Green. When you live as a minimalist, could you describe some of the things that you do that you might not have done 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, to be honest, the way I was raised in a military family and we just had thrift as a virtue, and we also visited a lot of the state and national parks as a family, so the emphasis was always on resources and conservation. So I have mostly naturally been drawn to that, and I've also lived overseas in central Tokyo and traveled in a lot of European capitals where things are just smaller and more dense. And so my aesthetic, as well as my social conscience, just happens to go that way. I would say that for me, having metrics to aim at, it just gives me numbers to aim at. So I can be like, oh, look, this is how much water I've used today. Now, I don't call myself a minimalist. I call myself perhaps a selective minimalist or an ornate minimalist. It's possible for a person to live their own version of my lifestyle, and they could have 30. They could have 30 pairs of platform shoes. They could have 30 pairs of platform shoes. They could drive a Maserati, I suppose. I mean, it's kind of a flexible lifestyle, and it's supposed to be for each person to be able to adapt it to their own aesthetic and circumstances. I'm getting an echo of my voice, so if I sound weird, that could be why. But I wanted to comment on the March to the Mound from Monsanto, because I think that's going to be a great way to vocalize public sentiment. And at the same time, I think I would like it to be a Trojan horse, because ultimately the target, the real villain, is a lot of our cultural norms. Like, we consider it perfectly normal to irrigate this very large square of flat green grass.
Yes.
It provides nothing to any wildlife and no food for humans. And so we're really, the real villain is our own cultural norms that have become so pervasive that it ends up becoming the official policy to spray a park with Roundup.
So Jenny, what do you do with...
Sorry if I wandered too much.
No, it's fine. But probably 85% of the people who live here in the Tampa Bay area, if they own their own home, they have a big plot of grass in front of their house. Many of them water, even this time of year when it's raining every afternoon, they still water. So what do you do with your plot?
Well, I actually just moved into a house in March. I'd always been an apartment renter. I am trying to let some part of my property revert to dune, natural dune vegetation. I am planting kind of things that are found at curbsides. I just kind of stick them in the ground and kind of hope they'll grow. I carry all my water by hand, and I recently installed a hand pump. My house happens to come with a well. I recently helped a friend me install a hand pump, so now I can pump up water and hand carry it, which reinforces even more my decision. I really want most of my property to be overgrown by what naturally grows there and doesn't need irrigation. And then I'm not growing much food yet. I am kind of scaling up to that, but the food garden will be like a 4x4 raised bed or something small. I'm really into John Jevons, how to grow as much food as possible on whatever surprisingly little amount of space, that kind of aesthetic, that kind of mentality. I don't use very much electricity. I use only about maybe 5 to 8% of the average U.S. consumption of electricity, because I despise air conditioning. I despise it. I despise forced cool air. I don't like what it's done to our society. Everybody's locked up in these cool boxes, and nature's all set up. So I just happen to hate air conditioning. So there's a huge amount of my electric bill off right there. I don't use a water heater. When I need hot water, I just add a little extra to my coffee kettle. So electricity, I don't own a car, but I mean, I rent a car if I need one, or I ride share, or most often bicycle or use public transport. some categories I'm not so great in. I'm a brown thumb. I'm a terrible gardener. Sometimes I cry when people like Andy Furk or Jungle Jay or Corrine, they post about their great micro-agriculture ventures. I want to kind of cry, but then I pick myself up. Pick myself up and say, you know what, suck it up, just learn step by step, be humble. I know how to forage for wild edibles. I know those things. What else? Consumer goods, I just don't want that much stuff naturally. So it's easy for me to not buy very many consumer goods, and I prefer vintage clothing and thrift clothing anyway, so it's not hard for me to do that. A lot of the stuff in the riot for austerity movement is stuff that I just naturally prefer anyway. And
it really sounds... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make a point about my book, is that I use certain things, human impulses, as a Trojan horse for environmental action. For example, people really want to save money. So I use that to hook people in to do stuff that's naturally better for the environment. Or a lot of people are into the vintage thrift aesthetic, so I kind of promote that and talk it up, and that aesthetic becomes a Trojan horse for environmental footprint reduction, that kind of thing.
It sounds like you're really trying to teach the people that you have for probably more than clients, but everyone that's surrounding you, you're helping. I mean, you're living a minimum green lifestyle, and it's all encompassing, it sounds like. And I wouldn't worry too much about the edible food. I mean, that comes in time. And a lot of the times it's just you plant the wrong stuff and you have a failure and you feel bad. But I mean, you get bad, the right stuff. Like, that's what Annie was saying. Like, if you plant the right things, it will grow.
Yes.
But
And I'm also noticing just how much of our footprint is produced by needless work. Like, most people aren't willing to walk a couple blocks to the store, but they're willing to stand around chasing leaf with a leaf blower. Like, what's wrong with this picture? So, one of my taglines is, to help the planet, get lazier and more selfish.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, again, we're with Jenny Nazik, who just wrote a book called Deep Green, and we have Annie Ellis, which is a local landscape designer. We only have a few seconds left. Is there anything else that you guys want to say as far as getting in touch with you?
Oh, I just wanted to say that I thought that it was, this is Annie, and I just wanted to say that I love that you said that it's a very personal thing, that every person has their own level of minimalism. And to introduce it to the regular population easily like that really does make them grasp onto trying a little bit harder. It is a little overwhelming when you hear the word minimalist, but
yeah.
I think that when you do really look at it on a personal level, you reuse what you have and reduce. Bringing in more things, and it does work out. And I was on the edible thing too. I know a lot of people do struggle with that, but you know, whenever I do design work, I do bring in edibles for people that never had that before. And it just
nice.
Is such a little tiny toe poking in that they have a success with it. And if they don't, then I try something else with them. And then it turns into this wonderful thing of awareness that it opens them up. So that's all I want to say.
And Annie, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can Google me, Annie Ellis, Garden Design, or my telephone number is 813-361-8641. That's 813-361-8641. And my email address is msannielis@aol.com. See, I still kept my old... email address, so I'm continuing that.
And Jenny, if people want to find out more about your book Deep Green, how can they do that?
Well, and first I want to reinforce Annie's message about getting people out interacting with nature. It's almost like our own garden can be a little bit of a segue, a little bit of like a safe space between our indoor rooms and that outdoor wild nature that we've become so afraid of. So what a lovely, lovely concept. And I've set up a blog and website at www.jennynazak.com, and I talk about, I have links to my book, and I talk about personal aesthetics and things of that nature, and dealing with one's own personal shortcomings. So I really
All right. Well,
I want to make it accessible and fun.
Well, we are out of time. So, Jenny Nazak, thank you very much. And Annie Ellis,
you're welcome. Thank you
very much. And Tanya Vidovic, thank you. And John Butts, great to see you. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Should be back.
Great to be here. Thanks, Rob.
You'll be talking about native plants.
Yeah.
Well, you've been listening to the Sustainable Living Program. This is WMNF in Tampa. Frank Knox has been our phone producer today. Now we get the latest news from NPR. This is WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota.